I was thinking I should give my card to Sean so we could have a beer, because these are all the, we could talk for hours about all these same things. This is probably a lot like Sean's going to say, but I thought that the two prior presentations were a really good segue into to what I'm going to talk about, and I think, you know, the first being what Fred discussed earlier was the fact that, you know, how can we use a rather low-cost way to make decisions about health, and someone asked a question too about, you know, how did you know which churches to use? And I think, right, it's from moving out here to here, right? We still don't get to that pinpoint, the same thing as I think Sean was saying, but it's just sort of, you know, bringing it in a little closer so that we can make better decisions instead of being way out here. So with that in mind, I'd also like to acknowledge Roy and Dennis, who are from the Children's Health Fund in New York City, who've been wonderful to work with, and they're great contributors and collaborators for this. So anyway, my conflict of interest is I have done a little work for a company called American Medical Response, which is a big ambulance provider. They had some questions about how to provide non-emergency medical transportation. So, again, a lot of these questions came from the Children's Health Fund, and if you're not familiar with them, I think they fund, gosh, they have a network of, you know, 18 or 20, children's health clinics around the country. You know, what they found was that they invested all this money in providing services for children, and no one showed up. No one could get there. People miss appointments all the time. Why? And if you read the literature, you'll see, you think you've struck gold, go, ah, everybody solved this problem before, right? And you'll find that everyone mentions transportation as a barrier, but that's about it. So it's like, what is the real question about transportation? So that's sort of where a lot of this came from. So what do we find, right? They miss opportunities for immunizations, well child care. They have conditions, the chronic care illnesses that are not treated. They end up in the ED for non-emergency conditions, and so we find all of these things that happen because of these transportation barriers. My experience too, and again, why this is in Texas, was based a lot out of my work there. And what's so interesting that if you're familiar at all with Medicaid in Texas, they're still under this, what they call the FRU suit. So it's ongoing for 17 years now, and is based all about access. And of course, one of the most interesting questions about this was that, you know, children did not have access to care. Was it because they're the low payments to providers, that services were not available to them, and that the transportation just happened to be sort of one of these really big components of the lawsuit. So as a policy analyst, I cut my teeth on this, and then through my doctoral program, I've worked on this. So I've been on both sides of it. One of the latest things that we did was an evaluation in Texas a couple years ago. Let's see, we finished that 2010 with my colleagues at A&M. We find that, you know, 25% of the Medicaid population reports transportation or unmet transportation needs. So that equates to almost 500,000 children. 30% or 600,000 missed routine health and dental appointments because of those transportation barriers. Pretty staggering. Also, if we just look in Houston, so we notice too that as the household size increases, appointments get missed, right? Because there are none of these support services or anything to help someone who has other children at home. Medicaid has sort of these cumbersome policies so that if you have one child who's sick and one that's not, only the child that's sick can get service to go. So the other one, you either have to find out how to provide daycare or something for them, but so there are all these sort of things that make life tough on everyone. And of course, right, that folks didn't own a car. So not very shocking there. So what's the question, right? How do transportation barriers impact children's access to these primary health care services? Right, there's no direct measures. And I think, you know, our challenge was to account for automobile and public transportation availability, right? Because, and that was sort of the tricky piece of this. This problem is and this project's a little more complex than what I'll present here today, but I was just thought I would talk a little bit about how we tried to measure the availability of transportation. We also looked at Austin and Dallas. Our plan was actually to do the entire state, but you know what we found, just like everybody else does, is that you know the data just disappear in places, or it's so bad that you're just so uncomfortable using any of it. What did we do? We built this model around the Healthy People 2020 sort of determinants of health model, the policy making, health services, social factors. What's our proxy for transportation barriers? Were these children's ACS conditions, ambulatory care sensitive conditions, which is really just sort of a fancy name for avoidable ED admissions. So, and these are things like asthma, which by all accounts, right, should be controlled if you have good access to a physician. So, and if you have good access, right, and you're taking your meds, then you really shouldn't end up in the ED for these sort of acute episodes. But we find that these things happen a lot. So those were one of the things. That was how we measured that. So what did we do in looking at that? So, again, looking at the American Community Survey, so the percent of occupied households within each zip code tabulation area without an automobile. But, you know, what struck me about that was that that just wasn't enough. So because, you know, as I started thinking about it, well, you know, there's a lot of households that have automobiles, but there's only one. And so the person may take it to go to work. And when you think of Texas, right, I mean, it is all about cars, right? So you have to own a car in Texas to do anything much. So, you know, lots of times people get left at home without a car. So, and that's what struck me again, you know, what Sean was talking about and sort of the things that I've been thinking about too is this HPSA and MUA designation gets remade is that, you know, the question is really much more complex, right, than about the proximal distance or driving time, because if you don't have a car, then what does it matter, right? And if you're forced to get on a bus that's not very good and go sit downtown, like where I live in Grand Rapids, for 30 or 40 minutes before you can transfer to go someplace that really you could probably walk by the time, you know, you could drive there. But those things make things uncomfortable, right? I think our bus systems, our public transportation systems, again, not to beat anybody up, but are built towards getting people downtown, not necessarily to healthcare. So, and what else did I do? We, you know, I talked to all the metropolitan transit agencies. You know, we got all of their the sort of the X and Y coordinates for their transit stops. I removed all the commuter routes and built buffers around those just to try to figure out, you know, how much of a zip code truly is within a quarter mile that you could walk to a bus stop, which is what most people say is about as far as most people are expected to walk. But you know, the other thing that struck me, too, is that, well, you know, that's not really the best measure, too, because, you know, you could measure the transit system in New York City, for example, right? And just because you live a quarter mile in Houston or Austin or Dallas, that's not the same as living next to the, you know, the subway in New York. So how do we think about, you know, differentiating service availability and how good that service is? So I used a model that really wasn't sort of done for this, but I adapted it, done by some transportation folks down at the University of, I believe it's Southern Florida or South Florida or Central Florida. But they had sort of taken these metrics to think about how to rate the effectiveness and efficiency of these public transportation systems and looking at how often the buses run. Do they run empty? Those types of things. So that sort of helped us build these models. Again, here is sort of my correlation matrix again along all of these things. I thought, you know, what was kind of interesting here, I actually have a typo here. When we do the transit coverage, right, when we just sort of do the correlation matrices, you know, transit coverage wasn't that related to the rate of ambulatory care sensitive conditions ratio of cars to population, about 0.2, and then the driving population for the households with no cars was nearly 0.5, which I thought was really interesting, higher than poverty. And you know, that was, again, sort of one of our challenges, right, that everything always comes back to poverty. So, but it's more than just poverty, right? It's poverty, it's not owning a car, it's this HPSA score. So those are the things that we were trying to look at. This is always so funny when I don't convert the maps, because these are the FQHCs to dollar signs. So this is just hilarious. So if you have to load the font into the computer, so, or otherwise it turns them into dollar signs, but it's a sort of a clever or funny, ironic thing that those are there. But what you'll notice too, right? Again, red good, green bad. We standardized all of these rates across the county. That's Harris County. There's nearly 400,000 children on Medicaid alone in Harris County. So those right there are those red areas areas that where access or use of the ED for all those avoidable conditions is really, really high. So it's quite amazing. So it's not necessarily the relationship to these FQHCs. So here's my weighted index too, and you'll see, right? It's not exactly the same, so it's not a perfect measure, but it does sort of mirror those same sort of high areas with that we saw the problems. I knew this was going to be hard to see. You probably can't see this real well. These are the hash. So I did sort of a hash here and this red. So the hash is my transportation index, where the value, it was this 65% percentile and greater. So, and then the same thing here, where these avoidable ED admissions, the red, are the same. So these were, where we were trying to identify, well, these are areas that have, sort of high transportation barriers and sort of high utilization of inappropriate ED visits. So after we started looking and thinking about that, too, and I think, one of the things that we started thinking about as well was that, what are some of the solutions to some of these problems if we start to think about these? And we did a little factor analysis, again, sort of looking at all those variables there. And we came up with three groups, and we have, sort of the pink, right? And those are our tough, inner city, kids. These are very low income, not unlikely to have an automobile at home, high minority. But they're close to public transit, which I thought was interesting. As we start to move away some of these green areas, so these are really very similar to the pink areas, only that what? They don't have any access to public transit. So it's not like we can go give bus tokens to everyone. So, but they're also unlikely to have automobiles. So we have to think about what's the appropriate thing for those folks. As we move away, these were more well-defined, and again, right, if you get away and you get outside of, sort of the urban areas, when you think about how the HPSAs are defined, then they go to the county level. So they're not quite as useful, but because, the HPSA score sort of shows up for all of these things once we move outside of Harris County, it's kind of interesting here. But, these are those health professional shortage areas anyway. These people are also likely to own automobiles, but also, more likely to be low income. But it's probably what? More of the distance problem there in these areas than obviously here. So I think, that was sort of our strategy, was to think about, what do different people need, and how can we go and begin to start thinking about some of these problems? I just wanted to throw this up, and not to get us completely off track here, but this is actually Austin. And the only reason why I showed this, because I had sent this to some colleagues who kept saying, well, what about proximity to the ED. So have you ever looked at that? And so this struck me as very, very interesting. This pink shading here are my buffers around the public transit system in Austin. So the red are the hospitals with EDs. These blue here are my F2HCs, and then the green is sort of the purport, or the number of kids on Medicaid in each of those. And if you've ever been to Austin, and the reason why I showed this Austin just because it's so fascinating, Austin is almost completely segregated by I-35. I mean, you've got East and West Austin. So West Austin is where UT is where all the everybody who's anybody wants to live in Austin. And then East Austin is very low income, this is a growing Latino community, African American here. But what is so fascinating to me is look exactly where these bus routes end, right? And then when I did my hotspot analysis, that was where the really high ED utilization came. So it was right. It had nothing to do with the ability to walk into the ER, right? That you actually have to get in a car and go to the ER if you live out here. So, but for whatever reason, right, it's that these folks, right, these kids are not getting the preventive care that they need. So I just found that pretty fascinating, and this to be, you know, one of the most telling maps that we did. I thought, Ian, about talking more about this facial regression, but I realized that this was a GIS section, and so I didn't want to kill everybody with a boring regression. So I think, right, yeah, you know, there's the things that we're starting to find, right, is to tease out the things other than just poverty. You know, distance is very powerful. The availability of the primary care providers, little relationship there. You know, what are some of our limitations? The ED data just goes over a cliff. I mean, it's terrible. You know, once you get outside the rural areas, we tried so many ways to predict and try to estimate some of those. So I think, you know, we've got our work to do with the rural questions. I think, you know, what is this? This is the first research that we can find that sort of that systematically examines the impact of transportation at on a community. So I think also what do we need to think about is consider this range of mobility solutions. You know, what always fascinated me, and I talked a little bit about, you know, the challenges of Medicaid and you know, how hard it is to, if you have, you know, a big family and some of the kids don't qualify. But, you know, what strikes me is the other thing is that, right, you know, there's no transportation benefit for WIC. There's no transportation benefit for virtually all of these other wraparound services. So, you know, just because we can get you to maybe your well child checkup, we need to think more about some of those things. You know, there's a lot of new research and interest in these food deserts. You know, and anecdotally, we had a lot when we were doing the survey. You know, a lot of folks would tell us that, well, they went to the doctor, called in, had their prescription filled by Walgreens or something, and then they didn't have any way to get there. So, right. So, what good does it do you to go get your primary care visit and then be unable to fill your prescription for your inhaler, right? So I think, you know, those are really interesting questions. The other thing that struck me, we've got to make better use of public transportation. So, and I mentioned, right, almost 400,000 children on Medicaid in Harris County alone. When I did some initial estimates, 190,000 live within a quarter mile or less of one of those bus stops that I used. But yet, public transportation accounts for less than 5% of all of the Medicaid-paid transit trips in that county each year. I mean, you're talking about a couple thousand. So when I started working in the Medicaid office, Texas spent $17 million a year in 96 or 97 on Medicaid medical transportation. This year they'll spend $255 million. So, you know, and results are getting worse. So the other thing too, which I thought was good, what Sean did, is that sort of where we want to end up with a website like that, where we can kind of predict, so that you could go in and again think about, if you have a site, thinking about where are those mobility challenges, where are those transportation barriers, where you might be able to go in and think about that and provide some extra benefits for those. So that was perfect, as I was beeping on me there. Roy and Dennis and myself are finishing up the technical report. So there's this giant technical report, and I don't know whoever asked the question too about how did you estimate from blocks to zips. There's some we have that in our estimates to, or in this technical report as well. Again, probably more GIS stuff than anybody wants to know or think about, but at any rate, a lot of it's there. So,
Steve, can you just, the last, on your findings slide, you had the point that said that the proximity to primary care providers didn't have a relationship. Can you just highlight that point again, because I somehow missed that?
Well, that when we took, and again, there's a lot of data from HRSA where that has the number of practicing primary care providers, right? We found that when we did the ratios, and you know, again, I think a lot of that problem too is just who accepts Medicaid exactly. Just because they're there doesn't mean much.
Right.
So it's not that I probably should have qualified that.
That's okay.
That
I just
better.
Wanted to try.
But you're right. You're right. That's a very good question. So it's not to say that it doesn't matter, because I think it does.
But in the way you could easily, with the way it was modeled in this. Instance.
It's very difficult to know who sees the types of patients that we were looking for. So,
one or two questions for Steve before we go on. You'll get a chance later, Dr. DeMille.
You said that there's transportation available for Well-Child, but not for WIC. Has anybody put WIC and Well-Child appointments together so that they can kind of get it as a
well, and you know, that's the great thing with about a lot of these FQHCs is that they provide some of those things. It is those the clinics that do those things. But right, if you're trying to coordinate this by yourself, right? There's no one that, you know, if you go out and make your appointment with, you know, Dr. Smith, and then you've got to go to the WIC clinic. There is a transportation benefit, right, but not, and not all the FQHCs provide transportation, which I noticed too when I was reading that used to be something that was in the UDS data set, which is no longer collected. So I was a little disappointed that data no longer exists as well. So. I'm sorry, the is for the entire system. Yeah, it's for the entire system, right. Again, it is exactly, it's a proxy. You know, and when you try to start taking into account, you're exactly right, all those things that we started thinking about and the things that you want to do, the things you have to leave behind to get to some sort of bigger model. But you're right, very good point, very good question. It would be nice, but yeah, it's an effectiveness rating as compared to all transit systems in the United States. So
thank you so much.
All right.